this morning, I had one of those moments in life where I saw an article pass my vision, and I said, I've got to talk about this with Jan. So we're going to
talk. The KABU resident psychologist.
Yeah, exactly. Resident psychologist. And we always pick the movies that have the most psychological depth as well to review. So, Jan, I'll have you as my expert today, but let me just start with a little bit on this article we're going to talk about. And I'll start with a quote here. If power were a prescription drug, it would come with a long list of known side effects. It can intoxicate, it can corrupt. It can even make Henry Kissinger believe that he's sexually magnetic. But can it cause brain damage? So this is the lead question in this new article in the Atlantic Monthly for the July-August edition. Power causes brain damage. How leaders lose mental capacities, and most notably, reading other people. The subtitle's a little confusing. I'm going to leave that for now. But the article's written by Jerry Usom, who covers business and economics for publications like the New York Times and Fortune magazine. The article explores the science behind bad behavior of powerful people and is kind of making the rounds, as I said, on social media with the promise of speaking to the fears and anxieties of having powerful and seemingly deranged CEOs and presidents run the country. So, and the promise is a promise. We'll see where that promise leads. So, as I said, the full article is titled alludes to this notion that there's a deficit that's created through
and if it's found power. And if it's in the brain, it must be real.
Reading
this article remind me of those 1980s PSAs. This is your fried eggs. This is your brain on drugs.
Exactly.
And this is we should have fried eggs. This is your brain on a power trip.
On a power trip. And, you know, it's interesting stuff. The article goes over the research on the ways that power impacts the brain and the resulting behavior and the diminished capacity, particularly for empathy, which I know you can speak to. And essentially, power impoverishes people. But to what ends might that scientific study of power and the brain lead? We'll try to cover as much of this as possible.
Well, the first part of this article brings in neuroscience, and it's become a habit of journalists to cite neuroscientists to establish that something's real. So this mirror neurons claim, which is it has its own kind of fictionalized mythology attached to it. I mean, there's something there, but I think this idea that if you can see it on an MRI or neuroscientists can establish some correlation with something going on in the brain, it makes it more real in a scientific sense. And there is an interesting social science literature on the impoverishing effects of power for a very long time. But I think often what's missing is the long literature of oppressed people who have diagnosed their oppressors and the way in which oppressed people suffer depression and anxiety and have to contain their anger in unhealthy ways, but that the oppressed are diminished and impoverished and in many ways that they disavow. I think the issue is the disavowal and the denial of the pathologies of power. Franz Fanon wrote quite a bit about the psycho-existential complexes of the oppressed. Albert Memmi in a classic book from the 50s that's still very timely, The Colonizer and the Colonized, talks about different pathologies of the colonizers and their identification with the colony. And I think feminist and black studies, Native, Indian, Latino, Latina studies in the 1970s really rejected what had been a kind of liberal social science perspective that oppressed people suffer deficits and we have to provide measures for them to catch up and to score higher on the measures in place for self-development or self-realization. And many argued that it's the oppressor often that suffers the bundle of deficits, that lacks capacity, and that there was a whole set of studies that unfolded that showed that women were better. Initially, it was thought, argued that women are better at reading nonverbal cues, develop greater social intelligence, reading facial cues, body language. But then another wave of studies concluded that it was oppressed people who are better at reading subtle social clues, that the oppressed don't have to. And I think the new wave of revived by the anxiety over Trump, this new wave of interest in pinning a diagnosis on him and interest in what the same article calls the hubris syndrome, in some ways misses the point of these more relational approaches. Mammy talked about the colonizer and the colonized, the oppressed and the oppressor, that there are dynamics that are bad for people who are oppressed and the oppressor in societies based on racism and class oppression and sexism.
You know, one of the things that drew me to the article that I think I really believed would be there or not be there, again, I guess we're talking about deficits. So one of the big deficits is, in the interest of studying powerful people of a particular ilk, presidents, prime ministers, CEOs, we don't have a real broad sense of what kind of power we're actually talking about or the range of power.
Some of which are effective forms of power, and some of which are hold more or less of the consequences of people's lives.
Right.
Power in a ball game is not the same as, in general, as power over people's livelihoods or controlling their environment.
Right. Yeah, we're not talking about chicks dig the long ball here. You know, it's not a game. It's not a game. It's very consequential. And so the context of that is capitalism. So for a writer who I've never met, but I will say, as if his interest is in economics and corporate power, et cetera, that's one place where power is exhibited to the detriment of really everyone. And you talk about
controlling the conditions of people's lives.
Yeah, understanding disorders as not an individual experience the way that I think this science sort of leads to, because it's focal on the brain, but that there's a social component and that there's a reciprocal or a dynamic between social structures, communities, etc., where people are damaged by this stuff.
Yeah. And I think most of the disorders that are advanced as ways of diagnosing someone like Donald Trump still locate pathology within the head of the individual as a kind of deficit model and fail to attend to the relational dynamics of even everyday mental disorders, that often there's a context, there are consequences that are either there or not there for people in power. Harvey Weinstein, for example, had a host of enablers and people who benefit from this behavior or look the other way, so that I think the pathology that sets the center of this hubris model is not having checks on power. And I think even among our own progressive leaders, if you're the biggest thing in the room and you get this mirroring back without being accountable to people and having consequences, that there is a social pathology of power that is, I think, the more important dynamic. Maybe we can return to that later time. I'll share my favorite. If you're going to pick a diagnosis from the DSM, I have one that I think is more apt than narcissistic personality disorder, the usual one, or antisocial personality disorder. There is a relational dynamic going on with Trump and the public, and I think it's important for us to confront how much he inhabits people's psyches, how much focus there is on him versus his being a product of this culture and conservatives. He's not just an anomaly, a pathological person coming out of nowhere. He's a product of this society and the political forces in this society.
Yeah, that's really the important note, I think, to end on. Right.
Yeah.
Jan Hocken, Denise Morris, we've been talking about the article in the Atlantic Monthly by Jerry Usom, Power Causes Brain Damage. We'll link it on our website. Thanks, Jan.
Thanks.